Please be seated. Well, my notes tell me that we have more students here today, students from New Berlin Eisenhower High School. If you are here, would you please stand? Oh, my, very nice. You may be seated. The students are here on a program that they're involved in with the court called Court with Class. So, again, they will know a little bit about the case that you're going to be arguing here. If the students can remain after this case is finished, Justice Annette Ziegler will come down and chat with you a little bit about the proceedings and how cases get to the Supreme Court and a little bit about the work that we do here. So if you can stay, please do. Before I call my second case of the day, I want to note on the record that Justice Shirley Abrahamson has withdrawn from participation, so we will sit six on this case. Are you prepared to proceed? Okay, then we will begin with State versus, well, I guess it's Fitzgerald versus the Circuit Court of Milwaukee County this time. Thank you.
May it please the court, Assistant State Public Defender Colleen Ball, again appearing on behalf of the petitioner, Raytrell Fitzgerald. In the previous case, we were discussing very heavy burden that the state must meet in order to win an involuntary medication order. This case is about the next step. If the state wins that involuntary medication order, then how do we protect the defendant's right to appeal so that he does not suffer irreparable harm? And last term, this court held in State versus Scott that that an involuntary medication order is subject to an automatic stay pending appeal. The state may move to lift the stay, but it's going to have to address a modified version of the Gudenschwager factors, which, for ease of reference, I am going to call the Scott factors. So, it appears that circuit courts are confused about what triggers the automatic stay and also about the stay lift procedure. So I would like to begin by saying that State v. Scott is perfectly clear in my view, and this court should leave it exactly as it is. However, I think what the problem is, and it's a problem we discussed in just the last case, for 16 years, circuit courts have been ordering involuntary medications under a different, much more lenient standard that defers to doctors. And involuntary medication has been the default, the rule, not the exception. And change is hard, okay? And to ensure that the lower courts get the message that Sell applies in Wisconsin and that in Scott, when you said that there had to be an automatic stay, you meant it. I think this court should use its superintending authority to make a couple of additional points clear.
And are there different policies that drive the determination, well, actually the order for the court on a post judgment matter that the defendant is proceeding on, as was the case in Scott, and what we talked about before, which was a pre-judgment order?
Your Honor, I don't think so. Scott used broad mandatory language when it said that involuntary medication orders are subject to an automatic stay pending appeal. And in Scott, the court also said that it would be extremely rare, if ever, and no one could think of a circumstance where involuntary medications should be appropriate in the post-conviction context. So that portion of Scott appeared to apply to all involuntary medication orders.
What I was really focused more on is if you have a pre-trial competency proceeding, then it's the state pushing to try that person for the crime of which the person was accused. If you're looking at post-conviction competency proceedings, it's really the defendant that's driving the bus, not the state. And my question was, does that make a difference or should it make a difference?
It shouldn't make a difference. In both instances, the defendant has a constitutional liberty interest in refusing medication. In the post-conviction context, he's not asking for medication. Again, it's the state. So the question here, Sell comes into play, and I think Scott, therefore, comes into play whenever someone is trying to render the defendant competent for a proceeding and the defendant doesn't want the antipsychotic medication.
But it isn't the state that wants to have post-conviction proceedings.
Well, it's what it was in Scott, Your Honor. It was the state. The defendant didn't want it.
Okay. Well, yep. You're looking at something different than I'm looking at. I'm looking at a post-conviction proceeding that the defendant brings because the defendant feels he has rights that will be vindicated in that proceeding. Okay? So he drives the bus to have any kind of post-conviction proceeding, not the state. It's once he starts it that, yes, the state did ask for medication in Scott. My concern was whether we should be evaluating pre-trial differently because the state is driving the bus. They are pushing on a conviction, and they're precluded from going forward by the lack of competency of the defendant, where in post-conviction, it's the defendant who's driving the bus. He's the one that wants to go forward. I mean, maybe you don't think there's any difference. To me, they seem different. But
I understand. I guess I would respond in this way, Your Honor. In federal court, because that's where we have more experience with this issue, these orders are stayed pending appeal in the pretrial text. None of the cases cited in the previous case were the orders moot at the point that the appellate courts were deciding it. And so I think that should also be the rule here. We're talking about irreparable harm to the defendant. If this court says you can go ahead and medicate, there's not going to be an automatic stay, then there is no way that the defendant can appeal an involuntary medication order. It's too late at the end of trial after he's already been medicated.
Well, counsel, didn't you suggest a potential remedy for that in your brief? So page 14, you mentioned this. Trial counsel has no time to do legal research, order a transcript, consult appellate counsel, or determine the pros and cons of appealing the involuntary medication order. But you said right after that, trial counsel must arrive at the hearing armed with a notice of appeal to file as soon as the court signs the involuntary medication order. What's wrong with that?
Well, for one thing, you're going to be creating a lot of unnecessary litigation, and you're forcing the trial court to file a notice of appeal when he doesn't or she doesn't know at that point whether there's even any legal grounds for an appeal. If there's a pause, if there's an automatic stay, right, there's time to do a little research and you can figure out, well, wait, does my client want an appeal? Because the standard for competency is different between competency to stand trial and competency for appeal. Does my client want an appeal? Is there even any merit to an appeal? Do I ethically, can I file a notice of appeal? There needs to be a pause there so that some reflection can occur before counsel is forced to file a notice of appeal. And when you think about it, Justice Kelly, there's really two options on the table with respect to the trigger. There's the one that I'm proposing, which says, look, an involuntary medication order is automatically stayed when it's issued in order to preserve the status quo so that the defendant can exercise his right to appeal, because this court has said he has a right to an appeal as a matter of right. And then there's the circuit court's proposition, which is as soon as the involuntary medication order is issued, DHS can begin involuntary medication unless and until the defendant gets to court with a notice of appeal, and then somebody notifies DHS of the fact that a notice of appeal has been filed and also that an automatic stay is in place. And that's kind of a really important point here. We have to consider the practicalities of this situation. Public defenders represent human beings, and our clients are oftentimes sitting in institutions or jails or places where as soon as the circuit court signs an involuntary medication order, they can fax it over to the institution, and if the client says, no, 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 I don't want antipsychotic medications, well, the amicus brief filed in the last case tells you what happens. A SWAT team with a bulletproof vest and a helmet comes over and restrains him and jabs him with the medication. Now, how is it that a public defender is supposed to persuade Mendota or some other DHS institution, wait, we might exercise our right to appeal, or we just filed it the day after the hearing and the medication happened the day before? That's the problem. And really, it doesn't seem like such a difficult thing to say the order for involuntary medication is automatically stayed and until further order of the court. I mean, that's pretty easy. And so there has to be some additional showing made in order to convince the circuit court to lift it.
And you're asking for it to be made as soon as the order is issued, not after a notice of appeal is filed. Correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, well, how does your position affect the rights of the victim?
Well, Your Honor, I have two answers to that question. One possibility is that the government, when it's making its decision about whether or not it wants to bring a motion to lift the stay, or whether it's making its decision on whether there's an important governmental interest at stake in the self factors in the beginning, those two places might be places where you consider the victim. But I would commend to you, Your Honor, a case out of Arizona that's called Contner versus Lewiski, where the Arizona court specifically looked at that, and they said, you know what? When you're talking about involuntary medications, it's not enough to say that the victim also has rights. In this limited context, and I would note, Your Honor, that is a pretrial case, right? Pretrial competency standard. They say that the fact that the victim has rights is not enough to justify and say the government has a greater right to overcome the defendant's interest in refusing antipsychotic medications.
Looking at the victim's rights more from a timing perspective than I was looking at it from totally overcoming it, more looking at it as a factor that perhaps the court ought to be considering.
That's true. And let's address timing. There are things that the state can do to make sure this moves along. So because this is a civil case, it's governed by the 45-day 90 rule. The state, for example, can file a notice of entry of order, and that cuts the appeal time right there. And if the state really, really wants to move this along, it could not file a motion to lift the stay and let the matter be resolved. And there's another important point to consider here, Chief Justice Rogensack. When a circuit court declares a defendant incompetent, let's say DHS administers meds the next day, it's not like they become competent the next day. The second the circuit court declare somebody incompetent to stand trial, there's a long, long delay. So the victims are going to be waiting just by virtue of the fact that the person was declared incompetent.
How would the state let the matter proceed?
I don't understand the question, Your Honor.
Well, first of all, if the defendant is incompetent to stand trial and there's a stay of a medication order, your other comment to me is, well, the state could just let the matter proceed, but it can't go anywhere.
No, I'm sorry. I meant the state wouldn't move to lift the stay. It would allow the appeal to proceed is what I see. I'm sorry. I didn't make that clear. So I guess the first point that I was asking this court to consider in this decision is please say to the circuit courts that involuntary medication orders are automatically stayed when they're issued until further order of the court, and that's all designed to protect the defendant's rights, both to refuse antipsychotic medication, but also to exercise his right for appeal. And the second point I would ask, and this really goes back to the fact that cell marks a very dramatic change from 971.4. I respectfully request that this court tell circuit courts to say orally at the hearing the defendant has a right to appeal an involuntary medication order and that it stayed until further order. And that puts everybody who's in that courtroom on the same page. Because one of the problems we've been having here is DHS isn't in the courtroom, or some people in the courtroom aren't convinced cell applies, et cetera, or they're not quite familiar with the law. Making the circuit court say that is not something unusual. They do it regularly under 973.18, where the judge has to personally inform the defendant of his right to seek post-conviction relief and his right to counsel. It's really quite consistent with that.
Counsel, let's say we agreed with that and required the court to give that notification. What would happen if the court did not give the notification? Would it invalidate the order?
I think, Your Honor, that it kind of depends on what happens next. So let's say it failed to do that. On the other hand, the defendant got the automatic stay. Maybe it signs, because my next point is going to be change the mandatory circuit court form. If that says there's an automatic stay and, in fact, the order was stayed, no harm, no foul there. I'm simply saying this is an extra precaution given the dramatic change that we're about to announce to the circuit courts. This is an extra precaution that should be taken. But if the order is in fact stayed, I don't see why you would have to invalidate based on that.
So this would just be a recommendation to the circuit courts that they do this. This is it would carry no consequences if they didn't.
It might carry consequences if they didn't give the order and then if they didn't make the notice and in fact there was no stay and the person was in fact medicated. I'm just saying there could be situations where there might not be any harm to it is my point. The third point, and because Justice Kelly, this kind of leads right into that. We have a lot of problems with the mandatory circuit court form. And one of them is that one change that I think this court should make is that it should say on it in bold letters that this order is stayed until further order of the court. And while normally I would say that circuit courts have the ability to fill in some blank lines on it or supplement it with something, it would be very dangerous to let them do it here because circuit court judges and their clerks are, of course, extremely busy, and sure enough, one of them will accidentally leave that sentence off of the mandatory circuit court form. So just put it in there and to make sure that when that order gets faxed to DHS, there's no mistake, the order can't, involuntary meds can't begin until there's a further order of the court.
So, counsel, let's say that we agree that the stay begins upon entry of the order. So it's actually a stay pending further order of the court rather than a stay pending appeal. What's to preclude what actually happened in this case, which was the judge saying, okay, I am entering the involuntary medication order, it's stayed, and I'm lifting the stay.
So in this case, Your Honor, I think that what saved the day was the fact that the defense team got a petition for supervisory writ in at the Court of Appeals and then said to the court, hey, you didn't follow the Scott factors, and then everything stopped. So this case is because someone went the extra mile to try and get the involuntary medication order stopped.
So let's say there was a little bit of a So the morning, the involuntary medication order gets entered. The court says, and by virtue of what the Supreme Court said, it is automatically stayed pending further order of the court. And, oh, by the way, the state just moved to lift the stay. We'll hear that this afternoon.
That I don't believe can happen, Your Honor, because the next point of clarification I'm asking for is actually just to require the state to follow the statute 809.12. That motion to lift the stay should be written. It should be filed with the adequate notice to both the trial judge and to defense counsel as to what the grounds for lifting the stay are. And I can't think of a circumstance where you can file a motion in the morning and get the hearing in the afternoon. There's like a five-day rule or, you know, there's some sort of requirement. And you need that, Your Honor. And the reason you need that is you need a transcript. The court, in order to address the Scott factors, cannot possibly know whether the first one is satisfied. Is the state likely to succeed on the merits of the appeal without a transcript to know what the testimony was?
Well, or maybe it's something like this. The state says, okay, I know what the Supreme Court requires. Supreme Court requires automatic stay, then I have to move to lift the stay. So here's what I'm going to do. When I call up to make the motion for an involuntary medication order, I'm going to schedule two hearings. One of them is going to be to get the order, and one of them is going to be to lift the stay. And so I come to court armed with that. The court sits in the morning, heard the testimony, come back in the afternoon. You don't need transcripts. Same judge, he just heard the testimony.
So if I were that trial judge, I'd be extremely irritated for the district attorney scheduling two hearings, one of which may not even be necessary. Crowded calendars. I think that's where you'd run into the problem there, Your Honor. And I don't
that's
a practical answer.
It might be a practical answer, and it might apply in some counties, not others. In some counties, perhaps there's not quite as busy a docket, and the court's not going to mind having a morning and an afternoon hearing. And why do we care whether the circuit court minds having the hearings back-to-back anyway? The question is, what is going to be required of them, right? And if the procedure that we set up invites this back-to-back hearing procedure where all you're doing is having this apparently false division between the hearings, and the same judge is going to be hearing the same case, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, what have we accomplished?
You don't, and that is why you have to follow 809.12, which requires a written motion, which is going to have to comply with the local rules in terms of notice to opposing counsel and to the circuit court judge as to what are the grounds for the motion to lift the stay. People need to know going into the hearing, well, what is it, district attorney, that you think went wrong or has some circumstance change that we all need to know about? I mean, that, I would argue, Your Honor, is a violation of procedural due process, not to give defense counsel and the circuit court judge enough notice to know how to prepare for in order to meet the state's case.
Except 809.12 is a motion for relief pending appeal.
Exactly. And there are all different kinds of motions for relief pending appeal. Some might be a motion for stay.
But there might not be an appeal.
Well, 809.12 loops back into 808.075, which says whether or not an appeal is pending, a circuit court may grant. In this instance, what we have is an automatic stay with the Supreme Court telling, that's what the Supreme Court's telling the circuit court, there's an automatic stay, and the relief pending appeal is the state seeking to lift that stay. Now, very important point, in addition to the fact that the state needs to file a written motion, the state, and realize, they don't have to move to lift the stay. Nobody's requiring them to. If they want this to move along, they don't have to do that. But if they do, I think it's extremely important that the circuit court judge have a transcript. It should be the same circuit court judge in both instances, but if these hearings are 2 weeks apart and everybody has appeared in court and argued, you know, 10 different cases between then and the second hearing, if appellate counsel comes in for the defendant, which is entirely likely, that person would have no familiarity with what the actual evidence and the testimony was at the hearing. And so I would ask this court to require that if there's going to be a motion to lift the stay, that at a minimum you have the transcript so that people can address whether or not the state, in fact, has a substantial likelihood of success on the merits.
Counsel, I want to go back to 809.12, and it's entitled Rule, parentheses, Motion for Relief Pending Appeal, parentheses. But there's nothing in the text of 809.12 that makes any reference to an appeal. Does there have to be an appeal filed? How long do you have to file an appeal here?
80912 says a person seeking relief under 80807, but we also know that 808.075, and this is what your answer to your question, Justice Bradley, 808075 says, in any case, whether or not an appeal is pending, the circuit court may act under 809.12.
And I guess for me, what I was thinking about and musing on is whether or not for relief pending appeal is more of a term of art. In other words, it doesn't apply. 809.12 doesn't apply only in cases where there subsequently is an appeal.
I agree, Your Honor. So here is the relief that that Mr. Fitzgerald is asking. First, reverse the Court of Appeals decision that says a defendant must file a notice of appeal to trigger an automatic stay, because if that's the court ruling, Scott really didn't do any good. These defendants will be irreparably harmed by the time they get to appeal. And secondly, issue the requested writ, because here we have a circuit court that acted, orally said that it was going to lift the stay without addressing the Scott factors, and the circuit court intended to act, that is, lift the automatic stay in violation of the Scott factors. So that's why the court should issue the writ. And even though subsequent events rendered that moot, this court can still issue that writ. In the cases cited in the initial brief, it's State X. Rel. Olson versus Litcher, and it says that an appellate court can issue an extraordinary writ when doing so is going to provide guidance to the circuit courts. And if this case shows anything, it's that the lower courts, the Court of Appeals and the circuit courts and the bench, and the bar, public defenders and district attorneys, need some clarifications both on the trigger for the stay and the stay lift procedure.
Can we counsel, don't you think that our decision in this case will address all of that? I mean, you've spent last hour talking about it and this hour talking about the same circumstances. I don't see why we need a writ and a decision from this court on the issues you've raised.
Well, on the writ, it is ensuring that the circuit courts apply Scott factors before they lift the stay.
Well, if we tell them to do it,
sure,
I think they will do it.
That was my question. Can we provide the guidance that you're requesting without issuing the writ in this case?
Well, I think because of the procedural posture of the case, if you're saying, can I reverse the circuit court? Of course you can reverse the circuit court, but what we have requested is a writ, and you have the authority to do that. However you accomplish the end, the goal is to help the circuit courts, right? Okay.
But I mean, can we exercise our superintending authority without issuing the writ?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Assistant Attorney General Abigail Potts, and I represent the Milwaukee County Circuit Court in this case. And really, there's just one point that I want to make today, and that is that the Scott case automatically stayed involuntary medication orders pending appeal. And if this court wants to go in and revise that, it can, and it can make those orders stayed at the time of order. But what the government would ask is that you carefully consider the policy implications of doing so. And I think that's what I've heard today that you are. So I want to stress those today. From the government's perspective, the burden on the government, when I say government, I mean the courts, I mean the Department of Health Services, the institutions, the burden on the government from staying every single involuntary medication order, regardless of any intent to appeal, far outweighs any inconvenience on a defendant from having to simply come armed with a notice of appeal to trigger that stay.
When you talk about inconvenience, didn't we say in Scott that this was a significant constitutionally protected liberty interest to avoid the unwanted administration of antipsychotic drugs?
You did, and we don't disagree.
It's not just an inconvenience, right?
We don't disagree that this is an important right for defendants.
So what about there's a couple things from a practical perspective, but so you're saying that in every case you would have defense counsel come armed with a notice of appeal, regardless of whether they've had a chance to determine whether they want to appeal the case, and then you would rely on the system to get that notice sufficiently to the Department of Health and Human Services so that the person was not actually medicated. And that's just from a practical perspective. That's how you're asking us to let this work.
Basically, my response would be that what we're asking is for the court to leave Scott as it is, and what we're saying, our main point, is the burden of having to file a notice of appeal is much smaller than the burden on all the other parties, and the defendant included, in staying everything, effectively delaying critical medication and the criminal justice process for that 45-day appeal deadline in every case, even if the defendant really has no intention of appealing. And so Fitzgerald, the crux of his argument, I think, has an initial appeal to it, and it's that, look, we need to protect defendants while they decide whether to appeal. And there's an initial appeal to that, and initially I think that seems reasonable, but when you really look at the burdens involved, it poses some significant problems. And what we're seeing, at least, and is that circuit courts are able to do this. People can file a notice of appeal the day after, and we're not seeing people medicated the same day this order comes down. If there's any fear of that, their counsel could ask for a discretionary stay to bridge that gap if they needed to. But what we're seeing is that it's easy to file a notice of appeal. It's a fairly simple document. You don't need to go into the merits of the appeal. And what that does is it allows the court to know that there's a genuine intent for this person to challenge this decision. And it also starts the procedure going. Because let's keep in mind, let's step back for a second and remember that what we're doing here, that at the point in time when an automatic stay becomes relevant, someone has already flagged this defendant as possibly being incompetent. Oftentimes it's their own defense attorney. The agency has done an examination and issued a report finding the person incompetent. And the state, as we know now under Sell and from the first hour of discussion in this court, the state has a very significant burden to establish the statutory requirements and the Sell requirements. Opposing counsel admitted that at the very beginning of her argument today in this case, that the state has this dramatically heavy burden. We've established that at the point that this automatic stay is becoming relevant. The state has provided a ton of evidence. We've done a lot. We want to get this procedure moving for so many reasons. We have victim rights, which the Chief Justice referenced, but that's not the only thing we're considering here. We're also considering the well-being of the defendant. And I think this is an important point that gets kind of lost in the briefing on this case.
I always am a little suspect when the government is telling me it's for your well-being that I'm imposing involuntary medication. That just doesn't resonate. It may resonate with others, so perhaps it's a good argument. One of my concerns is statements advanced by your opposing counsel that it has become the default in Wisconsin to order involuntary administration of medication when the defendant is adjudged not to be able to make an informed decision about the advantages and disadvantages of the psychotropic medication. The law, I believe, is clear that this should be rare. The forced administration of psychotropic medications by government should be rare. And I get the impression that it isn't, because the standard being clung to is that which is set forth in the statute. Is the person able to appreciate the advantages and disadvantages of the psychotropic medication? So, first of all, is it as default-oriented or rampant, is another word of saying it, do you think, as what your opposing counsel is suggesting?
That's a good question, and I don't know. Honestly, this record has nothing in it
So, but you've read other transcripts.
Sure.
And when I was a circuit court judge, it was before Sell came out. And I can tell you that the language of the statute, you know, was gospel. I mean, that's what we, you know, can they make a decision, an informed decision about the advantages and disadvantages. End of story. And it was not in as it wasn't rare.
It wasn't. Well, I would agree that this should be rare. This is, I mean, the state does not want to have to medicate people involuntarily. And I think it should be even rarer in the post-conviction context, which is the Scott case. I think there is a larger government need in the pretrial context when you have individuals who really do deserve the right to be tried, because they will then just be held. And that's kind of what I was referencing in, we wear a lot of hats as the state, and we have to protect a lot of parties, the courts, the institutions, Mendota and Winnebago, and managing their bed space. We also have to protect the defendants. And I think we kind of alluded to this earlier, that in the post-conviction context, who is pushing this? Is this the state or not? Well, the state is actually trying to help defendants as well. I think
there may be difference between post-conviction and pretrial, mm-hmm. vis-a-vis the state and the burdens on the state. But in terms of the liberty interest involved, I see no difference.
I think that, well, that's true. I think the liberty interest stays the same. I think it is easier for the government to show an interest in the pretrial context, which is where we are. And one of the reasons that the government has more of an interest in the pretrial context is there are lots of parties that we are looking after. And it's those parties and those players in this game that get burdened under Fitzgerald's approach here. And let me give you a couple examples. Under Fitzgerald's approach, every single involuntary medication order, hopefully not too many of them, but every single one gets stayed at the time the order is entered. Now, that just leaves Mendota, Winnebago, the courts, the crime victims, and even the defendant kind of sitting in limbo, probably for the full 45-day period, unless a defendant affirmatively notifies everybody that they're not going to appeal, which I don't imagine happening. So let's say most of the time it will be that 45-day window. What that does is then really create a lot of delay. It also creates questions on who's going to notify the institution that the 45-day deadline has passed. So administratively, Fitzgerald's approach is really not very workable. And it also burdens all the people who are trying to get the criminal process going. Now, it does not, our approach, and what I believe to be the Scott approach, which just requires the filing of a notice of appeal to trigger that stay, that does not eliminate the very protected right of an individual to not be medicated. It requires a small showing of an intent to actually pursue an appeal and a filed document in court which notifies everybody that this automatic stay is going to happen. So it's procedurally practical.
Paragraph 44 of Scott gives the rationale behind the Scott decision. And it calls its rationale, its reasoning, quite simple, it says. Mm-hmm. If involuntary medication orders are not automatically stayed pending appeal, the defendant's significant constitutional protected liberty interest in avoiding the unwanted administration of antipsychotic drugs is rendered a nullity.
Yes, and what I think the Scott decision does very well is says the minute you file your notice of appeal, no discretion, you get your stay.
Okay, where in the Scott opinion, and I haven't done this, but I would guess, I've read the Scott opinion now a few times in preparation for this. Where do you find the words notice of in the Scott opinion?
We don't.
So how can you say the Scott opinion intended that this is triggered when a notice of appeal is filed? I didn't see notice of, and I looked for it, but, you know, sometimes I miss things when I look for it.
It would be easier if it said that. It says pending appeal.
It says pending an appeal, and then in paragraph 45 it says again, because involuntary medication orders are automatically stayed pending appeal. Mm-hmm. So they're automatically stayed. It seems to me the idea of not having, I read Scott as requiring it to be, the order to be automatically stayed. That's the way that I read it. And the rationale, the simple rationale behind it set forth in paragraph 44 endorses that interpretation.
Well, and this court wrote it. So part, the state is also here for guidance. But from the state's position and from the government's position, making that stay triggered by a notice of appeal is not that burdensome, still has a lot of certainty for a defendant, and relieves a lot of the burdens that would be caused from a delay of every case. And I think you still achieve the objectives of an automatic stay, which is giving the defendant the power to stay this. Well, they make this decision and how they want to appeal, but they also have to show some intent to appeal here. And
let me go to that. They have to show some intent to appeal. So you would have that at the moment that this decision is made, that the individual who likely will have different counsel on appeal, if they're a public defender represented, which most of our individuals are in the state, I would venture to guess, knows at that very moment, despite the fact that they have 45 days to actually think and file and actually do the, you know, pursue it, but they should know at that very moment that they're going to appeal, and they should come armed to court with that piece of paper that absolutely has no meaning because they wouldn't have been able to have given any meaning to it. So that's what you'd rather our system be?
Well, I don't actually think that is a bad scenario or an unreasonable thing. I think that many of these individuals will know that before they go into this, whether or not they're going to want to appeal involuntary medication. And if they...
What if they decide later, let's say they don't come armed, and then the next day they decide to? In the meantime, they've been given a shot? I mean, you want them to make that decision on the spot. That's the burden you're shifting by not having an automatic stay.
But Scott, I feel, does, is it provides defendants with this tool that if they want to use, they file a notice of appeal and they get an automatic stay. So they still have all the tools of discretionary stays if they want to ask the court for a discretionary stay and say, hey, court, you just ordered involuntary medication orders. Can we have 2 weeks to decide this?
So it's only automatic if they actually do something to make it automatic. Otherwise, it's not automatic.
Start an appeal pending.
Okay.
Yes. And again, it seems rigid. But when we look at the practical implications of the positions, it really helps to reduce the burdens on the agencies who are trying to efficiently judge and calculate bed space. And let's keep in mind there is a waiting list for bed space.
Well, wait, they're still committed. This just has to do with the medication. If they're being treated to competency, this has nothing to do with bed space.
But there's specific bed space for active medication. So when you're being actively medicated to competency, you have to get a bed space for that. So there's lots of things that the agencies have to consider, and just delaying every case, regardless of any intent to actually appeal the decision, is once again another burden on the state, the circuit courts. Who's going to notify the agencies that the defendant's appeal time has run? It creates a lot of logistical problems. Whereas filing a notice of appeal is not a large document. You don't have to have your whole appeal determined yet. It doesn't start your briefing schedule. What it does is notifies, I'm going to appeal this. You get different counsel. Different counsel decides that, nope, we don't have a good issue. You voluntarily dismiss your appeal. It's not the end of the world. But you never have to worry about being involuntarily medicated. Now, I also think that we're
talking... Except if you don't file it at the very moment that the decision's made. Otherwise, you could worry about being involuntarily medicated.
But that's then file it. I mean, that's a small situation, and let's keep in mind where we're at again. You've already had the state satisfy its, as opposing counsel said, its very high burden of showing the cell factors. The state has done a lot. There's been a lot of protections at this point of defendants, okay? So let's not... This isn't... That's where I believe we need to separate the technical position that we're arguing in this case from the overarching constitutional right to not be medicated against our will, because a lot of protections are being afforded to that right, and we agree with that. But logistically and pragmatically, to trigger the stay in Scott, you should have to file a notice of appeal so there's actually an appeal pending. Then everybody gets notified by that, and you have time after that to decide whether you want to continue that appeal. But we also then have some certainty, because the cases that then actually get stayed are cases that should be stayed, as opposed to every case getting stayed. We are talking about critical medication, not necessarily dangerous individuals in this situation, but individuals who a lot of different people have determined need this medication. At this point in time, it is not unreasonable to ask a defendant to step up a little bit and file a document.
And this is for non-dangerous, though, right?
These are non-dangerous, exactly.
Dangerous is a different avenue.
Whole different mm-hmm.
What about
can of worms.
Just having the state take that extra step and file the motion to lift the stay?
Well, and that's what Fitzgerald proposes. And I would say we've already done a lot. At that point, we have satisfied a very high burden, and we prevailed. And now Fitzgerald is basically wants to create a system where we not only have to satisfy another burden, but provide transcripts, even though we prevailed and we're trying to protect all of these entities and further the criminal process. It's an unreasonable burden on
the
state.
Well, let's take out the transcripts. Well, actually, I should ask you about the transcripts. You're saying, because I saw that piece was something that you thought was too much of a burden. From a practical perspective, who would file the transcripts? How would that work otherwise?
Well,
if they filed a notice of appeal anyway.
An appellant would get the transcripts on appeal.
So the person filing the appeal would get the transcripts.
Right.
All right, so even if we took out the transcripts, what's wrong with having the state come armed to court with their piece of paper that says they want a motion to lift the stay?
Well, look at it like this a little bit. We have just spent time evaluating this individual, drafting a report, going to court, making our showing, satisfying the statute, satisfying cell. We get an order, and now under Fitzgerald's approach, we have to go back, and we have to show why we will win again, and that there's no irreparable harm, and you know all the factors for a motion pending appeal, but in this case to lift the appeal, basically the same factors, and that doesn't seem reasonable when the alternative is simply file a notice of appeal.
Counsel, in Scott, I'm hearkening back a bit to the Chief Justice's question about Scott being post-conviction, and then Justice Bradley's follow-up about Scott not saying you have to file a petition to appeal. The facts of Scott, as I understand them, were that in 2009 he was convicted for a number of crimes, and it wasn't until 2015 that they were counsel was dealing with him with respect to post-conviction relief. And defense counsel said, boy, I'm having a hard time here. I'm not convinced that this person is competent to assist me in post-conviction relief. And so then went to court and asked for a competency determination with respect to that post-conviction assistance. Then the court said, yeah, we have a competency issue. They had the hearing. The court issued the involuntary medication order. And then that order, there was leave to appeal that order. And then the Court of Appeals denied the petition for leave to appeal, lifted the circuit court's stay of the involuntary order. Then the defendant appealed the involuntary medication order as a matter of right and filed an emergency motion to stay the medication order pending appeal. So that was the backdrop of Scott. There was an actual appeal, and there was an actual determination of guilt already, and the entirety of the appeal in Scott originated with the fact that in these post-conviction proceedings, Scott wasn't competent to help counsel. So what are we to do in that scenario? You have, in a competency hearing, I've had an a lot of these at the trial level. Often, it's defense counsel who often says, to some degree, I'm having an issue here, and I'm not convinced we're ready to go forward because I don't think this person can meaningfully participate. And then the court has the hearing, and you go forward. So the person who can't meaningfully participate with respect to the ongoing criminal matter then is in this appellate process where will there just be another request? Because, I mean, that'll be contemporaneous now if the petition for appeal is required. There will be a new competency hearing on the inability to deal and assist with respect to the appellate process. Where does it end is really my question, and how should we really deal with that? And given the backdrop of Scott and there being actual post-conviction relief issues being addressed and then an actual appeal in place, do you have any different answers to anyone's questions previously?
So what I'm kind of hearing you ask is, what is the long-term effect of this appeal, and how does it differ in that post-conviction context a little bit? And I would say that this is one of the reasons that Scott's a little bit of a, not a difficult fit, but we have to fit it to this case because we are in a different context here. We're in the pre-trial context. So in this case, the individual is declared incompetent to proceed to go to trial. And it would be the decision, the appeal of the decision on the involuntary medication order that is triggering the automatic stay of that order. And from my reading of Scott, and just taking the term of art, pending appeal, it would be pending that appeal, that automatic stay would run throughout that. So that would be.
Because it was pending appeal. I mean, that's
yeah, this is a different context because obviously it was post-conviction, so there might be an appeal of the substance of the conviction that is separate from an appeal from an involuntary medication order. So you might have two different types of appeals going on here, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, is that kind of what you're wondering about?
The person who was just determined not competent to go to trial then is going to fairly immediately appeal. And presumably, appellate counsel will say you're not competent to assist me in my appeal.
Oh, right.
So
right.
At what point
and who determines?
Do something to move the ball forward here? And is that what the statute might be designed to address?
Well, and this is kind of a good question. These cases are difficult because by their nature, there's a complexity to when you have a defendant who is simply incapable of participating. Who is deciding whether to appeal the medication order? Is it their defense counsel who initially flagged them as being incompetent? That is why the state wears a lot of hats in this situation, and sometimes the state is involved in that post-conviction context saying, hey, we think this guy needs to be medicated, even though we won at trial and we got him convicted. So it's a difficult situation, and I would imagine that defense counsel is going to be the one who is continuing to appeal, even though defense counsel is the one who also is bearing the burden of his incompetency and his inability. So I don't have a clear answer for you. It's a complicated procedure, and to figure out, not procedure, it's a complicated situation because the incompetence of the defendant really does affect it differently at different stages in the proceeding. But the automatic stay in Scott, I think, is designed to really address the medication order section of the appeal as opposed to the substance of the criminal trial or something like that. But my reading of Scott is we are trying to protect individuals when they are appealing an order to medicate them.
Yeah, counsel, could I direct your attention to paragraph 47 of Scott? And perhaps
what was it? The paragraph 47 of what?
47 of Scott.
Of Scott.
And perhaps tell me if that informs us on the timing of when the stay commences, and also the timing of the evaluation of the motion to lift the stay. So point one, the first element that the state has to establish to lift the stay is a strong showing that is likely to succeed on the merits of the appeal. And is the state capable of doing that before it knows what issues are on appeal?
I think that if a defendant files a notice of appeal that generally states the issues on which they would appeal.
Sometimes.
It would depend on how detailed the notice of appeal is, I guess I would say. In some cases, I think yes. I think we're going into these proceedings, you know, fairly, this is a fairly confined universe. It's a report from an agency that we've all seen. And generally, that is a lot of the evidentiary, the substance of these decisions is that report. So I think there's a lot of information going in where I do think that as long as there's even a vague description of the issues appealed from, I think the state could respond to that.
So let me put it another way. Would the state be able to bring an effective motion to lift the stay if it has no idea what the issues are on appeal?
No.
Okay. And then looking at paragraph 48, and perhaps you could comment on this with respect to the tribunal that would address the motion to lift the stay. In paragraph 48 says, whether to grant the state's motion is a discretionary decision, and as we explained above, the Court of Appeals must explain its discretionary decision to grant or deny the state's motion. Does that have anything to inform us about when the stay becomes effective and what tribunal addresses the motion to lift the stay?
I think that might go more to where the motion is going. And this does seem to say the Court of Appeals. I think the state is of the opinion that we do not oppose a reading that Fitzgerald proposes as well, that it could go through the 809-12 process and go to the trial court first. I can't tell you what the court was thinking when it mentioned the Court of Appeals. They may be thinking, but from the state's perspective, we are fine with an interpretation of this decision that and the statutes requiring the motion to lift to be in writing and go to the circuit court. So we don't oppose that.
That's specific to the facts of Scott, why they spoke of the Court of Appeals. That was a unique factual scenario I kind of went through.
That's before. What I assumed.
I don't think they meant to say, because typically you have to try to get the relief at the trial court and then show why you couldn't think. Right.
Well, I see that I'm almost up in terms of time here, so I want to kind of...
Can I ask just a question? I have a problem with this notice of appeal and the ethics involved, and where in our jurisprudence do we ever have someone file a notice or file a document upon which there may be no basis? So you're saying the notice of appeal has to be filed right at the time of the order. Okay. So we have a situation where the attorney perhaps is, of course, not able to communicate effectively with his client. So the attorney is to decide on the spot what is to be appealed. Seems problematic. And that ties into Justice Kelly's question about how can you know that you're going to prevail on the merits unless you know what's going to be appealed. I think very often a notice of appeal, as in this case, as you see in the Appendix 130, doesn't give a basis. But how can we be requiring a notice of appeal without talking to your client, without knowing if there's any legitimate basis, without even thinking about, you're talking about bringing it to the hearing with you and filing it. Maybe there's no basis, it would be a no-merit appeal. I mean, so these are all problematic consequences of what you're suggesting, and I just can't hold on to any other part of our criminal or civil procedure that would be akin to saying you file a notice without any idea if it has any merit, without any input from your client.
Well, I would argue that you can get input from your client. We're talking about, again, a procedure where you've got this report ahead of time. You can presumably talk to your client who, again, let's remember, has been declared not competent to stand trial. But you have time to talk to your client before that hearing and figure out a contingency plan. I would hope that if there truly is no merit to appeal, that you wouldn't appeal and you would let the critical medication be implemented or applied and the trial to go forward. But if you're nervous about that and you really think there might be an issue here, you're not quite sure what it is, but you, I don't think it's that big of a burden to file a notice of appeal, even a general notice of appeal with kind of general issues, which I do believe you will know, because again, these hearings are going to be confined to a pretty limited record of a report and, you know, testimony from a limited number of people. I don't think it's unreasonable to say to trigger that automatic stay, you need to file a notice of appeal. It's not a burdensome document. If you would like more time before you file your notice of appeal, you can always ask the circuit court for a discretionary appeal. But we're just saying don't automatically stay every single order, because there are going to be orders that we need to get moving. We have already satisfied our burden. There are lots of people's interests at stake here. So on the ones that we can move forward, let us move forward and not wait 45 days, which is really the result. So that's all I have, unless you guys, my red light is on. If you have any more questions, or we're, I'll
thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to begin by addressing the Circuit Court's parade of horribles, which I think is also the biggest concern this court has about the automatic stay procedure here, and that is, are we going to have backlogs? Are these cases going to be held up? Are we going to have appeals within appeals? Are there going to be enough beds at DHS, et cetera? And the answer to that is no. If this court tells circuit courts they must follow CEL, involuntary medication orders are going to be really rare, and then there will be very few appeals from involuntary medication orders because there will be few involuntary medication orders. So that's the first answer to all of the problems that opposing counsel just mentioned. There's not going to be that many appeals to begin with. And Justice Ziegler, you mentioned a concern about, well, they've been found incompetent to proceed at trial, then it'll be incompetent to proceed on appeal. In the rare circumstances where there is an involuntary medication order, I doubt that that's going to happen. You mentioned that you had been involved in many competency proceedings. I've reviewed many involuntary medication transcripts and worked with many clients in this context. And there's, while I would say it's true that many defendants, when they're mentally ill, might not be able to understand something as complex as a trial, because those are complex, if you say to that same client, do you want meds or not? They can say, no meds, no meds. And that tells you then we're going to have an appeal. I don't want the meds. I want to appeal. And it's because these people with mental illness have oftentimes had these medications before, and they know the side effects.
I agree with you. I think sometimes defendants and people subject to medication orders know their medications and the effects on them, the negative effects on them, better than other people might recognize. What's missing sometimes is the positive effect that the medication has on them, which allows them to meaningfully contribute to the proceedings and live a life where they're not dangerous to themselves or others or things like that. I mean, I don't know what Justice Bradley's experience was, but I can honestly tell you, I think when I've issued involuntary medication orders, I think it was in the defendant's best interest to do that. And they virtually always were better off after having had that. But it only comes into play if, knowing that order is there, they nonetheless say, no, I won't swallow the pills. That's when it comes into play. They still, it's not like they're strapped down and just a SWAT team comes in and stick the pill. That's only if, despite that order, they still choose not to take what the doctor is trying to say they need for help.
So here's my first response to that, Your Honor. When we're talking about CEL and pretrial incompetency, medicating someone for competency to trial, that's all we're talking about. CEL applies. If we're talking about doing what's in the defendant's best interest because he's mentally ill and a danger to himself or other, we're under Chapter 51. were not under 971.14. So in that context, everything that Your Honor said, I agree, might be true. That medication may be in his best interest. But here, where cell comes into play solely where he's refusing medication for competency to trial. And we have to kind of keep that focused. Now, there's another point I wanted to make here.
Counsel, before you get to that, could I direct your attention to paragraph 47 of State versus Scott? And what I know is, want to know is whether we need to change the first element of the standard the state has to meet to lift the stay order if there is not an appeal. Because the first element is make a strong showing that it's likely to succeed on the merits of the appeal. And if there is no appeal, the state doesn't know what's going to be on appeal. So how would they do that?
If there's no appeal, there's no need for a motion to lift the stay pending appeal.
Yes. Except that you got the stay,
right?
So if we agree with you that the stay commences immediately upon the filing of the medication order, then the state says, well, okay, we need to know whether we should try to lift the stay. But if there's no appeal, how are they supposed to satisfy element one?
Well, you wouldn't move to lift the stay if there's no appeal. But the real answer to your question, Your Honor, is if the defendant has no intent to appeal, the 45 days will expire, or more likely the public defender and the district attorney are talking and they say there's not going to be an appeal, maybe he waives his right to an appeal. So that's how that's going to resolve itself. It's not, the state is never required to bring a motion to lift the stay. Never.
But they might want to. They went to all the effort to get the involuntary medication order. They did that for a reason.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the court agreed with them. The court says, yes, you are entitled to the involuntary medication order. However, Supreme Court requires that we stay this immediately.
Right.
I'm imagining the state is going to want to lift that stay, right? And how are they supposed to do that if there's no appeal, and so they can't evaluate the merits of an appeal?
Well, I think that comes back to the point Justice Ann Walsh Bradley was making. You can still request relief. And though there's no appeal pending, and that's in effect what the state would be doing there.
But the first element is success on the merits.
Exactly. It is. And
but you don't know what the appeal is going to be about.
That is precisely why the state would need to bring a motion and have a transcript, because there wouldn't be any way to address or resolve that.
Thank you.
I guess this is how.
Thank you, Counsel.
Oh, thank you.
We are going to take a break now for noon, and we'll be back at 1:30 for our third argument. Justice Ziegler will be down in just a little bit to talk to the students and anybody else that cares. We are adjourned.